to the podcast of the City Club of Eugene, Oregon. The City Club builds community vision through open inquiry and is dedicated to enabling an informed public on a wide range of topics. Coming up in today's program.
But the very first thing I want you to think about when we think about how we might or might not use this technology is how the lines often very blurred. And so one of the things that I think we need to be thinking about is, who are we developing the technologies for? Who will benefit and who will be harmed?
We appreciate the sponsors who make our civic work possible, including Kaiser Permanente, kp.org, Lane Community College, lanecc.edu, Peace Health, peacehealth.org, the University of Oregon, uoregon.edu, Lane County, and the City of Eugene. And here's today's program.
Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's February 26, 2021 program, Designer Babies, Prospects and Problems. This is the 22nd program for our 2020-2021 programming year. My name is Scott Coltrane, and I'm the City Club President. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and our sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Our programs are always available on our YouTube channel and on our Facebook page, and are broadcast on public radio station KLCC 89.7 on Mondays at 7 p.m. In today's program, we welcome presenter Françoise Baylis, professor of bioethics and philosophy at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada, who is this year's Wayne Morse Chair at the University of Oregon. Biographical information on our speakers is available on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. I would like to thank Joel Corin, president of our program committee, for coordinating today's program. Designer babies, once found only in science fiction, have become a reality. We are entering a new era of human evolution with the advent of a technology called CRISPR, which allows scientists to modify our genes. Although CRISPR shows great promise for therapeutic use, it raises thorny ethical, legal, political, and societal concerns because it can be used to make permanent changes to future generations. What if changes intended for the good turn out to have unforeseen negative effects? What if the divide between the haves and the have-nots widens as a result? Who decides whether we genetically modify human beings, and if so, how? Dr. Françoise Baylis, the author of Altered Inheritance and the 2021 Wayne Morse Chair, will discuss the ethical questions presented by this new technology.
Well, it's a pleasure to be able to speak with you today about a topic that I care deeply about, and I hope you will too, at the end of this broadcast. So the topic is designer babies, prospects and problems. And I want to say thank you at the outset to the Wayne Morse Center for Law and Politics for making this possible. The reason I think a lot about this topic is I spent a couple of years recently writing a book called Altered Inheritance. And I really aimed that book at the general audience. I wanted people who had an interest in better understanding both the science and the lively ethics debate to have something that they could read that would spur the imagination. So what I want to do today is briefly describe some of that science for you, and then talk to you a little bit about what's possible and why we want to think very carefully about how we want to use this science to make a better world for all of us. So very briefly, let me talk to you about the science. When I think about genome editing, I think it's really important to understand that we're talking about making modifications to one of two kinds of cells. They're called somatic cells or germ cells, and these are the two kinds of cells we have in our body. Now, somatic cells is just a fancy word for body cells. So all of the cells in your body are your somatic cells, with one exception. And those are your reproductive cells. So when we think about your egg and your sperm, those are the germ cells. But behind them, there's what we call the precursor cells, the cells that make the egg and sperm. Those are also part of the germline. And the very, very early embryo is considered part of the germline. So first thing to know when we're talking about making modifications to DNA, that we find them in two kinds of cells, body cells and reproductive cells. Now, the second thing to think about is that we have two broad kinds of objectives when we set about trying to modify the DNA in these cells. And I think you can think of them broadly in the following ways. Some of those objectives are going to be health related, and that can be in the context of offering therapeutic interventions, but it can also be in the context of offering prophylaxis. In other words, trying to prevent a problem in the context of healthcare. So think, for example, about vaccines, but they're health related. So we've got an objective that's health related, trying to improve the health condition of people. A separate broad category is under the banner of enhancement. And there, the goal is actually to improve upon this model. So you might be thinking of any number of ways in which some people might think that our body is deficient, and that there are ways in which we could make a better body for ourselves and maybe even a better brain. Now, in that context, different scientists over the years have used a range of different kinds of technologies to try to achieve these goals, to manipulate one or other kind of cell in pursuit of one or the other objective. But the most recent of that science is now known casually, if you will, as CRISPR. And sometimes it's referred to as CRISPR-Cas9. And that's an acronym for a very long word, clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats. It's a mouthful. And so we don't use that. We refer to CRISPR. And by and large, you'll hear people say CRISPR's faster, it's more accurate, it's more efficient, it's cheaper. All of that's true, but all of that's also relative. It's relative to the other technologies that were around attempting to do the same kind of thing. Now, the only important thing you really need to remember about CRISPR is that it's made up of two molecules. One of those is called the guide RNA, that's the CRISPR, and the other is the Cas9, which often gets dropped off when we're talking about this technology, and those are the molecular scissors. So what you have is you have a guide RNA, the CRISPR, that's getting into the cell. It's taking the molecular scissors to a very specific spot where you will make what's called a double strand cut. So the technology is to go in and cut the DNA. Now, that might be all you do is cut the DNA and allow the cell to repair the DNA. So then what you have is just a disruption. So you have disrupted the functioning of the gene. But sometimes, and this is really what's made it quite exciting for some scientists, you can actually go in and delete DNA, or you might go in and add DNA. And this is basically what we're talking about when we're talking about making genetic modifications. We're looking at that strand of DNA and we're going in there and making cuts in order to either delete, add, or modify information. Now, understand, since then, the science has continued, and we now talk about other ways in which this technology could be used. And I'll just refer to one of them, which is base editing. And the idea there is that you wouldn't be taking out segments of DNA or manipulating segments of DNA. You would literally go in and just make one change to one of those letters in the DNA. That's enough science for now, because it's really all you need to understand in order to embrace an important conversation about our future. What do we want to do with that science? What's possible? Well, I've already alluded to that by saying we could be looking at treatments. And by and large, people here have in mind patients with devastating, life-threatening illnesses. Examples would be things like Huntington's disease, sickle cell disease, et cetera. Another category is what I talked about before in terms of prevention, and we think they're of communicable diseases. And then the third category is enhancement, where we'd actually be choosing a particular trait that we want to improve upon. And right now, people talk about this in the context of sport. They talk about it in the context of intellectual capacities. They talk about this in the context of cosmetic goals and objectives. But the very first thing I want you to think about when we think about how we might or might not use this technology is how the lines between those three objectives, those three possibilities, is often very blurred. So let me give you two examples. The first one is, imagine a person who is of short stature. And they come to you, you're a clinician, and you're able to identify a particular underlying illness as the cause of the short stature. And imagine that you could offer some kind of treatment. That treatment could be right now a pharmaceutical, and in the future, it might be a genetic modification. And what you're trying to do is to respond to the outcome, which is that the person is of short stature, in a world where we know that there's discrimination against persons who are short. But now imagine another person comes to you and you do the same battery of tests and you don't identify any kind of underlying illness. And lo and behold, this person is perfectly healthy. They're the offspring of two people who are short. And so it was completely predictable that they would be short. That person, however, says to you, but I'm experiencing the same negative social consequences as the person that you've identified has a genetic illness. And so you're going to use the exact same intervention and call it a treatment for them. And for me, it's an enhancement. People sometimes have a little bit of difficulty with that case study because they're trying to think, what's the right response? And they have a lot of intuitions that I think are really important to think about. So one intuition is, if the problem ultimately is a social problem, the fact that we discriminate against people on the basis of what is in fact an irrelevant trait, relative, for example, to, you know, the goal in the workplace or in a school situation, et cetera, shouldn't we fix society before we start manipulating people's genetics? The flip side is other people think, well, of course we should respond because, you know, we haven't got time to fix society. We can go in and fix the genetics of those two individuals, but we're going to call one a treatment and one an enhancement. And then we have these intuitions that treatments are good and enhancements are bad. So the point of that example is just to cause a little bit of discomfort, if you will, around the idea that we know the difference between treatments and enhancements and that we're right to think that treatments are good and enhancements are bad. It's actually just a lot more complicated. Another example, somewhat different, is to think about vaccines. Is a vaccine an enhancement? It's actually fixing our immune system because our immune system's not working properly in response to a very specific virus. Well, the interesting thing about that is in fact the very first attempt to use this CRISPR technology in humans to create genetically modified babies that would have been resistant to HIV infection. That was extremely controversial, and I'll come back and speak about that case in a little while. Now that we can understand what it is that we might do with this amazing science, why isn't everybody just jumping for joy? Well, because I think many of us can anticipate a number of different kinds of problems, and one of the things to appreciate here is that what's a problem from one perspective is not necessarily a problem from another. And so what we need to think about is the ways in which we're all differently situated and can look at the same facts in terms of the science, but bring different values to those facts and therefore think differently about what would be a good use of that technology. So let's go back to the example I gave a moment ago about enhancement. In the abstract, most people think enhancement somehow is negative. We shouldn't be doing that kind of tinkering. Yes, of course, we should try to help people who are suffering. But if you already have what some people call typical species functioning, you shouldn't actually be using any kind of technology, be it pharmaceutical, be it surgical, be it genetic, to change your lot in life. Other people think, well, why not? If the model is flawed, why wouldn't you try to fix that? Well, the interesting thing for me is I then want to ask this pointed question. What counts as a flaw? So, for example, I now have white hair. I'm in the process of aging. Is that a flaw? Is immortality a reasonable goal? Certainly, some people hope to use this and other genetic technologies to unlock that key. And many people think it would be great to live for a very long time, as long as the body and the mind aren't falling apart. But I would then ask you to think about what would it really be like in the real world if we all lived till we were, I don't know, say 150. What does retirement look like in that world? Do you retire at 100 if you're going to live to 150? Do you retire at 50, get 50 years off, and then go back to work for the last 50 years? What about marriage? What do you do? Is that like a lifelong commitment? Do we now still think of ourselves in these sort of monogamous relationships? Or do we just sort of have contracts that we'll kind of live together for a certain period of those 150 years, and we fully anticipate that as we age, we'll change and we'll just turn in that model, we'll turn in that partner, we'll do something different because we're different. What about children? Think about all the technologies we have now that have pushed the age at which people can have children. Well, if you're going to live to 150, do you want them all really early so then you get on with your life and do other things? Or do you want to have a really fun time without any responsibilities and start having children later in life, like maybe in your 50s? The point of this example isn't so much just to ask the question about what's a flaw, but to actually invite people to think about when you make changes, are you thinking beyond the biological? Are you understanding the environment in which this new bundle of genes has to live, work, operate? The other thing I really want to stress when I think about genetic technologies being used in theory to address a flaw is for us to think about the difference between disease and diversity. One of the communities that's been really good at bringing this to the fore in the context of the current debate is the deaf community. And the reason they've been so actively engaged is because early on, a number of scientists have identified this as a flaw that could be fixed. And the deaf community has responded to say, well, wait a second, what makes you think it's a flaw that needs fixing? And some have been very clear. We're part of a robust community. We have a language that maybe you don't understand, but that's not our problem. And in fact, many of the problems that we do experience as a community are by virtue of the ways in which the majority has chosen to organize itself. A similar kind of set of circumstances and concerns have been raised by a number of other patient groups. And the one I'd like to name here is Down syndrome. And the reason for naming this is because it is something that has been identified as a disease for a long time in a context where these kinds of genetic technologies were not available, but other kinds of reproductive technologies were available. And over time, you saw a certain kind of growing intolerance for people with Down syndrome, the assumption being that women should have access to prenatal testing and should be making a particular kind of decision. And I think one of the things that's been very interesting is, again, for members of that community to say, you don't understand what you're talking about. We have a family member with Down syndrome, and it's a wonderful, loving family. And we don't see this as a flaw that needs fixing. And so I think one of the first things we need to think about is how might embracing this technology, which ultimately is about making decisions about which genetic traits are desirable and which genetic traits are undesirable, will have huge social consequences. And I guess one of the questions is, how much confidence do we have that the right kinds of decisions will be made? And more importantly, how will we understand what is the right kind of decision? And so I want you to think about the ways in which certain choices can perhaps unintentionally, unwittingly breed intolerance. Now, another thing that I want to say just very quickly at the outset before I get to the specifics of designer babies is I want to talk about something that's going to be a pervasive background concern no matter which technology we're talking about, whether we're talking about changes to somatic, i.e. body cells, or whether we're talking about making changes to reproductive cells, egg and sperm. And the problem that is going to be very real, I think, for the long haul, though some people disagree with me on that, is going to be issues of accessibility. So let's imagine that the technology is safe and effective. Let's imagine the technology works with respect to a very narrow goal, which most people are accepting of, which is, let's imagine it's about making changes to the body cells of a patient suffering from a disease like sickle cell disease. Each year, over 300,000 babies are born with a severe form of this disease. The majority of those people are actually born in low and middle-income countries. This is, for example, devastating in the continent of Africa. Now, many of these countries don't even have access to existing therapeutic interventions for this disease. Do we really imagine that they would somehow get access to genome editing technology? Do we imagine that it would be affordable either for individual patients or for governments? And so one of the things that I think we need to be thinking about is, who are we developing the technologies for? Who will benefit and who will be harmed? And I want to say that this is going to be true not only with the example I've just given about making changes to somatic cells, but also with respect to examples I'm about to give, which involve changing the germline, which involve making changes that will be inherited. And this is the critical distinction. If you make changes to body cells, those genetic changes die off when the patient dies. If you make changes to germ cells, and I'll just remind you, egg and sperm, precursors to egg and sperm, and the very early human embryo, those changes will be heritable. And the person with those changes, if they reproduce using their own genetic material, their children will have those genetic changes, and so on down the line. And that really is the crux of what many people worry about when they think about using this technology in this context. And the first thing for you to hold on to as a background idea is that there are no patients when you're making modifications to the germline. And so it really very clearly is a technology about choosing certain traits and identifying them as desirable, and then choosing other traits which are set aside as undesirable. For some of you, that's probably already starting to raise some questions about, how does this overlap with eugenics? Now, let me back up and start to tell you just a little bit about this technology, where we are today, how we got there, and the most important recent and subtle move from selection to design. And that's what's critical. That's the moment in time we find ourselves in with this new technology. So I want to take you back to 1978. In 1978, we had the world's first IVF baby. Her name was Louise Brown. The technology was being used to respond to a need that was identified amongst infertile couples. People who wanted to have children were unable to do so. And at the time, the biological problem that was identified was a blocked fallopian tube. Human ingenuity was, well, if the sperm and egg cannot meet because the fallopian tube is blocked, we'll just do an end run around it. We'll take the egg and the sperm outside of the body. We'll put them together in what's called a Petri dish, a glass dish, and we'll then put that new early embryo back into the woman's body, and everything will continue as it normally would have if only the egg and sperm had been able to meet in the human body. That is the beginning of where we are today, because that is the time that we, for the first time in our history, have that precious genetic material outside of the body. So we can observe it, but we can also manipulate it. In 1992, we have another very important event happen, which is that we have the birth of the first child following a technology called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And there, the objective is to avoid the birth of children with a particular illness and also indirectly to avoid termination of pregnancy, because what would happen is that people would get pregnant through prenatal testing. They would learn that the child was afflicted with a particular illness, and they would choose to terminate that pregnancy. In an effort to stop that pathway, they developed a technology whereby you would actually test the embryo outside of the body, and you would then only transfer back to the woman embryos that had been identified as healthy. Now, there's a whole debate about what would fall under that banner of healthy, but that's the goal, that's the objective. We skip ahead to the year 2000, and then we have another very interesting change in terms of technology. Not so much because the technology is different, but the use to which it's put is different. And so in the year 2000, we use that same technology of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, but this time not only to select against a trait that we did not want, but to select for a trait that was desired. So in the same context, trying to create what came to be known as a savior sibling, embryos were created outside of the body, and scientists looked for embryos that would have two features. They would have something called tissue compatibility. They would be an HLA match, such that this child, once born, could become a donor. And they were looking to ensure that they had an embryo that would not have Fanconi anemia, which was the illness that the child who was already born had. And so here you have creating an embryo outside of the body to find an embryo that could make a child that could become a donor, but you had to make sure that the child also was not going to have the illness. So we moved to selecting against a particular illness to selecting for a condition at the same time as selecting against a condition. We race ahead. We're now in 2016. And in 2016, we have for the first time what gets called colloquially three-parent babies. And in that context, the original goal, yet again, was to respond to an illness in the context of a couple who were at risk for having a child with a disease. I don't want to spend much time on that technology except to emphasize this point. The goal was originally to avoid something called mitochondrial disease. It's now being used almost exclusively to deal with infertility. But what's important about this technology is it is the first time that we move from selection to design. These are our first designer babies. So what's happening in that context is, up until this point, we have been pretty much getting the science right to create embryos outside of the body. And we're getting to a point where we can choose for or against certain traits within those embryos. But what we have with this development in 2016 of trying to change the mitochondria is truly an effort at design. Now, for those of you who are history buffs, there is an intervening technology called ovoplasm transfer, but that has such a very specific history, it doesn't merit the attention that I want to give these other technologies. 2016 to 2018, we then have our first genome-edited babies. And I've already made reference to this. I said that twins were created. The goal of the scientists was to ensure that they would have resistance to HIV. So in some sense, almost a genetic vaccine. Arguably, the goal there was, again, to help people who might otherwise become ill with HIV. And so the idea was to preempt that. So that's a very, very quick overview of how we got to be where we are today. And I want to suggest that where we are today is a place where I think it's reasonable to say we're at a fork in the road. And we have to make a choice about what we do with this technology, whether we use it, and if we use it, to what end. And in that context, in my book, Altered Inheritance, I review a number of potential benefits, a number of potential harms. I look at those benefits and harms, both in terms of the women who would participate in the research, the prospective parents who would like to have these children, the children who might be born of this technology. all of us in society, and ultimately the impact it would have on the gene pool. And I try to get people to think about the ways in which some people will see this as primarily of benefit, and some people will see this primarily as harmful. But I go beyond that and ask people to think about things not narrowly just in terms of what might be harmful physically or psychologically, but also to think about the ways in which we might be doing things that are just wrong. What do I mean by that? I think it's important to hold on to the possibility in looking at this or any other technology to get beyond what I think of as the basic hurdle of safety and efficacy and still be able to ask questions about the ethics. And so the claim I'm making is it isn't good enough for the science to be proven safe, meaning it won't hurt people, and effective, meaning it'll actually do whatever it's predicted to do, so you're not selling people a bill of goods. But that beyond that, there can be values brought to bear, which may tell us more about what we need to do once we've reached that sort of minimum threshold. Now, the interesting thing is, does getting to that threshold already put you on a particular path? And I think that's the question that's most challenging for us now. So by just taking you through what I think of narrowly as one facet of that conversation, which are the benefits and harms to children or prospective children. So what are the potential benefits to children? Well, first of all, birth. They would be alive. And many of us think that living is a good. And I think the point I'm trying to make there is we do know that there are parents who are, or I should say prospective parents, there are people who would like to become parents who say that unless they could be assured that they would not have children that would experience a particular kind of disease that runs in their family that they know to be heritable, they would rather not have children at all. And so part of the claim is that this technology will allow these couples to have children, and therefore one of the benefits to children is that they would have a life. Beyond that, the claim is made that they would have a healthy life because they would have a healthy birth. Now, you'll appreciate there's lots that happens from the time you're born that can put you on pathways that are not healthy, that don't have anything to do with genetics. And I say that because all too often in this and other types of conversation, we seem to reduce everything to our genes. And we are far more complicated than our genes. And I say that because we don't want to embrace any kind of genetic determinism. We do want to pay attention to gene environment interaction. So I think that's the first thing I want to say. The caveat that goes with those benefits is many people will point out that in almost all cases, there are alternatives available to prospective parents. In other words, there are other ways in which they could become parents and have healthy children. The challenge is those children might not be genetically related. And so I think that's a conversation we might want to return to. How important is it that your children be genetically related to you? But let me end then by a very quick overview of what I think are some of the potential harms to children. First of all, I don't think anybody can deny there would be physical risks of harm. That would be true no matter what we're doing. It's research, and the whole thing about research is uncertainty. We don't know what would be the outcome of this genetic tinkering. There might also be psychological harms as a result of some of those interventions. One of those psychological harms is we imagine that for some children, the way in which they'll make sense of their place in the family and in the world will tend to have them thinking of themselves as a commodity, as a product. And we talk about that as the commodification of children. And I think the reason that kind of worry makes sense is because of what I said previously, that all of this technology is ultimately about being able to choose certain traits. And so if you're busy choosing the traits that are going to be manifest in your children, how are you not thinking about them as a design project and ultimately as a product? Beyond that, some people have raised concerns about the rights of children to an open future. And the idea there is, don't we all have a right to determine our own path in this world? And what happens to children whose traits have been purposely chosen relative to a particular goal or objective? So this child has been made tall, in fact, very tall, because parents have plans for this child to be a basketball player. Separate from that, what happens to the rights of children to have a unique genetic identity? And I think one of the things that's really interesting there is that some people deny that there is such a right, but other people do worry about what kind of homogenization would you have over time if everybody starts to agree on these are the traits that are desirable, these are the traits that are undesirable, and we start picking the same kinds of traits to make one kind of a society. Now, please appreciate, there are many ways in which we can think about this as science fiction. There are also many ways in which you can put this off into the far, far future. And quite frankly, we may have annihilated ourselves by then, given the way we're treating the planet and our environment. But I think the point here is to create background thought experiments for people to understand what's the goal, what's the objective. And I think the last thing then that I do want to mention, because it actually is much more proximate in terms of a possible harm, are the risks of genetic discrimination. And in the literature, and beyond the literature, in public culture, there is an increasing awareness of the problem of the widening gaps between the haves and the have-nots. And in that context, I do ask people to think about the gaps we already have in terms of power and wealth, and to imagine how those with power and wealth might then take that privilege and entrench it in their DNA. And what does that mean for the rest of us? Those of us born as naturals, who haven't been genetically modified, who don't have those supposedly desirable traits in a bundle from the beginning. So I think that's been a little bit of a whirlwind tour. I hope I've touched on enough topics that we can have an interesting conversation on some of the pressure points. The big picture question being, from my point of view, what kind of world do we want to live in? And it's only in addressing that question that we know which path to take in the fork on the road. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Bayless. This has been our February 26th, 2021 program, Designer Babies, Prospects and Problems. And a special thank you to public radio station KLCC FM 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Mondays at 7 p.m. Our programs are always available on our YouTube channel and on our Facebook page. If you are not yet a member, more information is on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. This concludes today's program. Be well and stay safe.
If you enjoyed this presentation by the City Club of Eugene, please visit our website at cityclubofeugene.org or our Facebook page for more topics. We hope you are inspired to join us for our next podcast episode.